Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
Exploring our oneness with spirit and each other. Unity Online Radio.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today I welcome inspirational blogger, author, and presenter Scott Stabile to the show. His posts have attracted a huge and devoted social media following, and his new book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart, is quickly, or maybe not so quickly, but definitely, inexorably becoming a bestseller. Elizabeth Gilbert has called Scott a wonderful presence of love, advocacy, warmth, resilience, and grace. So it's a joy to welcome this presence of love today to the show. So welcome, Scott. We're glad you're with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Paul. I'm excited to be here.
You know, your book, Big Love, reads like a conversation to me. You know, it's lovely in that regard. It's like you're sitting down with a friend and he's sharing, you know, honestly and openly, you know, what's going on for him. And so you're drawn in to the various stories that you present. And some of them are quite harrowing, actually. But they're presented in such a way that you want to find out more. So it's very honest, compelling, unflinchingly real book, I think, and very approachable, like I said, to all of us dealing with the challenges that you describe. So I just want to ask you, are you doing, what you want to do with your life? And that's kind of a joke because that's the first question in the introduction.
Yes, I would say I can answer that question much more confidently today than I could for most of my adult life. And I would say I'm doing a lot. I would say what I'm doing in my life right now has been incredibly fulfilling. So I'm happy in that regard. I'm definitely on the right path, and I'm definitely spending my time doing stuff that that feels good.
Yes, yeah. And, you have this huge following, don't you, on Facebook, right? Hundreds of thousands of people, is that right?
Yeah, it's like 350,000 people. You know, they're not all tuning in all at the same time, obviously. It is Facebook, but it's been an incredible experience and a really supportive fun community there. I mean, if it weren't for that community, Big Love probably wouldn't be, for many reasons, in part because a lot of the writing that I've been doing on the page has shown me that there's really an audience for this kind of writing and work and talking about love and compassion and kindness and all these things that I feel are the most important things we have to work with in this world. And I also think that, you know, it helped me a lot going to the publisher and saying, I have this big platform on social media. I think they appreciated that.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's refreshing because many people who write, or many teachers out there, you know, come from a sort of a pedestal point of view. You know, they're up there. They've made the breakthroughs. They've become enlightened or whatever it is. So they're imparting wisdom to others. And not that you're not giving your wisdom to others, which you are, but you're doing it in a different way, I think. You know, there's no pedestal. You're telling people honestly the ways you've screwed up, you know, the ways that you've been traumatized, the ways that you've had to deal with overwhelming situations in a very real way, in a way that, you know, all of us feel at times, you know, that we feel the fear or overwhelm or I just simply, you know, you can't stand it anymore. I've got to get out of here. So I think there's an appeal there, you know, that you've experienced what I've experienced, and you have, of course, a chapter in the book where a woman on the plane is in grief, right? And the flight attendant comes up to her and doesn't say, "Oh, I'm so sorry," you know, as if which is the usual response to grief,
right?
But says in the say, "I've been there, you know, I understand." She empathized with her, and so there was a deeper connection. And we can't really empathize with people, can we? And unless we've been through the same kind of suffering, you know, unless we've been through the challenges that they're dealing with.
You know, I think that we can certainly empathize in a different way with people when we've experienced what they've experienced. But, you know, I'm a believer in empathy always. And I think that you don't have to know my exact experience of grief or loss, but you're going to have your own experience of grief and loss. And I think that empathy, as I see it, calls on us to try to imagine, if we really can't relate to what they're going through, to try to imagine what it might be like. To put ourselves in their struggle as much as we're able, so that we're not creating distance in the way that we respond to them. We're not just offering like an "I'm so sorry for you." We're doing what that flight attendant did when she bent over to the woman and she's like, "I've been there, honey." You know, we're doing our best to come from that place as often as possible. And I think, you know, in this world, in this country, in this moment, people are just screaming at each other, and they're so, you know, committed to being right in their opinions and so committed to making others wrong that so few of us are really taking the time, especially when someone posts something on social media that, you know, offends or disgusts or frustrates you, rather than retaliating with the same vitriol, can you remember the person's humanity? Can you imagine what their life has been like to lead them to get to this point of saying whatever it is they're saying? You know, and I believe, Paul, at least from that place, we're likely to show up to the communication without hatred in our heart and without the need to, you know, put our poison on this fire of poison that's already existing in the world. And that's all empathy. You know, empathy is a big healer, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a difference, isn't there, between saying, you know, "I've been there, I've had that experience, so I can feel some kind of empathy and extend some love," to saying, "I know how you feel." Because, you know, when you say, "I know how you feel," you're making that judgment that you've been in that person's shoes. And we can't do that, right? We don't know how they feel. But we've felt similar things, perhaps. But, I know when we were taught that as ministers, you know, don't tell somebody, you know, "I know how you feel," because they're going to say, "No, you don't, buddy. You know, don't lay that trip on me." So there's a difference between, you know, empathizing and taking over the person, you know, thinking you know all about them, right?
Exactly. You know, it's funny with my book. I come from a big family. I have a lot of siblings, and my sister, one of the chapters in my book is about my brother Ricky, who died from a heroin overdose and who spent his entire adult life addicted to heroin. And he was 18 years my senior, so my only recollection of my brother, my only experience of him, was through the lens of addiction. And my sister read the chapter, and we were talking about it after, and she said, for her, it was so weird to read the chapter because we, like, to your point, she and I experienced the exact same thing in that we both lost our brother to heroin addiction, but her experience of it was completely different than mine because she's older than I am, and she grew up with him as siblings who played together and had a whole entire relationship before I was even born and before he started using heroin. And so I don't know what she feels in terms of losing my brother, even though we both lost our brother, and she doesn't know what I feel because it's very different, even though it's the same loss, You know, yes. So you're exactly right in saying that.
Yeah. You know, we're all fighting a great battle, as the phrase goes, but and so, you know, be gentle with each other, as they say. But it seems like your karma has presented you with, you know, a huge amount of work this lifetime. You know, you must have said, bring it on, because, you mentioned your brother, you know, dying of addiction, you know, overdose, and then your parents also were murdered, right, when you were 14, and you've had other people die in your life, and some many reverses, so, you know, you've been through the mill, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the loss of my parents has been the heaviest, and the way that they died, you know, being shot to death, and having it happen at such a young age, you know, I didn't make sense of it for a number of years. I didn't even really allow myself to process it. At 14, I just buried it, you know, and moved on with my life. And even that, Paul, wasn't conscious. I don't pretend to have been this incredibly conscious 14-year-old who knew exactly what he had to do in the face of his parents' death. But something in me, subconsciously or divine intervention, knew that it wasn't something I could handle by facing it head-on at that time. So I locked it away, moved on with my life, was a really good student, and, you know, had a lot of friends. And once a year, pretty much like clockwork, I'd have a big meltdown cry about my parents and then lock it away again. And it really wasn't until my 20s when I graduated college, moved to San Francisco, got a job at a bookstore that, or a world gift store that had all these amazing metaphysical books. And it was my first time reading about enlightenment and being real with your pain and feeling your fear and doing it anyway. And all of these concepts that I'd never really approached with any sort of consciousness, but that felt really right. You know, when you feel like you've come upon something that feels like your home, even though it's your first time really experiencing it. And, you know, my world was really awakened a lot in those early 20s in San Francisco. And I realized that all the walls that I had created around my parents' death and not wanting to share the experience with anyone and making a big secret of it. It was also, I'd created walls to real deep connections with people. You know, I was only giving them this hyper-curated version of who I was. And I started to let those walls drop, and I started to share my story, and I started to cry, you know, more than once a year, and rage, and write down my feelings. And really, I allowed for the grief to be present for the first time, and it totally changed my life. You know, it completely deepened my connections with people, and it showed me that I don't have to fear my sadness. I don't have to fear my rage, that I can sit in those emotions and I will survive them, and they will move through me, and they'll come back again, and they'll move through me again, and all of that's okay in human.
Yes. Yeah, and I like that very much, the idea that, it, you know, it's not like we ever get over these things, that it's not like, oh, I did that, I released it, and it's never coming back. Of course it's coming back, you know, it's going to revisit, isn't it? But in a different way, maybe, you know, in a way that can be more helpful to us rather than overwhelm us and make us desolate. So, and again, it makes us more empathetic, I believe, humble, actually. You know, we're sort of broken open. You know, Leonard Cohen famously said, you know, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in, right? And you have a chapter called Crack Pot, based on that ancient story of the water pot that was a little cracked, and as we're all a little cracked. And of course, you know, what the story is, that the woman who was carrying the cracked pot with the other pot on the other side of her body was full, but the cracked pot was losing water. And what she planted flowers along that side of the path, right, so that the cracked pot watered the flowers. So, in other words, beauty came from the crack. Beauty came from the apparent, you know, less than quality of that pot. And in the story, that you tell, at least, you know, the pots are sort of anthropomorphized, aren't they? They have feelings, and
yes.
this pot feels really, really bad about losing half its
very
water.
Very guilty, yes. That's the beauty of parables, right? That you can give clay pots a lot of emotion in it.
That's right. That's right.
But you retold it beautifully and very concisely, and I think that's it's so important for us to remember. I think because we spend so much time hiding ourselves, we spend so much time trying to disguise those idiosyncratic traits that play into who we are, that play into our authenticity. And that takes so much energy, I found in my life, and is ultimately not really rewarding, you know. And the rewards come, I think, from sinking deeper into our truth and recognizing that, you know, no matter what, people are going to judge you, because people, we are all very judgmental, or tend to be. And so whether you're trying to fit in into some conditioned mold that's been created for you, or whether you're living authentically, you're going to be judged. So why not live authentically? You know, because the freedom that comes from that kind of life and the possibilities we create when we're operating from a more honest and truthful place, you know, there aren't words for it. It's life-changing. And part of that is just recognizing, like, yeah, I'm cracked. Yeah, I'm messed up. I have all of these things going on, and that's okay. You know, that all plays into who I am and what I have to offer this world.
Absolutely. You know, we were talking about this in the message on Sunday. You know, sometimes I wake up as, like my wife likes to call me, Mr. Grumpy. And, you know, Mr. Grumpy's no fun, really, you know. but he doesn't like to be told he's Mr. Grumpy.
Well, of course.
We've learned over the years that it's okay, you know, to be called out and called. And as when we can start laughing at me, well, here's Mr. Grumpy again, have a laugh about it. It dissipates the Mr. Grumpy right there, and it's sort of not so it's not denying Mr. Grumpy, but it's not giving that persona over much power. You know, it's saying
exactly.
That yeah, that's one of our tics, and we can laugh about it actually. And so Mr. Grumpy becomes quite an amusing fellow after a while, you know, because we haven't taken him quite so seriously, and I think there's power to that, isn't there?
Yeah, in all areas of life, not taking things quite so seriously.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think that's for our readers. You know, that's the fun thing about the book Big Love, is it doesn't take itself too seriously, even though it covers serious topics. It does it in such a way that you could be amused by it, and you know, it's has a comic essence to it, and the wordplay and the playfulness of the language is disarming, I would say. So it's fun in that regard. And you know, there's some chapters where you think, where's he going with this one? like tea time, for instance. I'm a British guy, so I love tea, black tea, actually, stronger the better.
Yes, of course.
And you know, you're a green tea, or were a green tea drinker, but then the tea time and drinking this green tea morphs into taking off your underwear and things. So it was like
this is an interesting
chapter. But tell us what you were trying to get to there.
Well, first and foremost, thank you. I'm really happy that you enjoyed the book, and thank you for all the kind words that you're saying about it. I really appreciate it. And as far as tea time, that chapter is about self-care, and the examples I use are two very basic examples. One was, for years, I would make green tea, and green tea is not a tea that can steep for too long, or it tastes really, really bitter, and I would never set an alarm. I would make it, and it really should steep for under 2 minutes, ideally, and I would always forget about the tea, and I'd come back to it, you know, 10 minutes later. It ended up tasting like hell. It was terrible, and I'd drink it anyway, and this went on for years until I finally and I was always looking. My phone was always right there by my side. It only took seconds more to set a timer, and I finally decided to set the timer on my tea. And since then, have always had a perfect cup of green tea, because I set it for a minute 45. It goes off, and I take out the tea bag. And I was also talking about how one day I was writing, And I had these really uncomfortable pair of underwear on, and I was shifting around in my chair, and I was giving as much of my mental energy to my underwear as I was to what I was working on. And it occurred to me, like, why are you wearing these underwear? You don't have to wear this pair of underwear. And I took them off, and I cut them up with scissors, and I went to my underwear drawer, and I took out a couple other pair that, you know, are uncomfortable. And I've been reading this story a lot on the book tour because people get a kick out of it. And every time I ask, like, who wears uncomfortable underwear, every hand in the crowd goes up, you know. And we continue to do these things and these habits that ultimately don't serve us. They don't serve our well-being. They don't serve our peace of mind. And though tea and underwear seem really minor, what I was trying to suggest in the chapter is that they're not really minor, because the energy behind those choices, the energy behind drinking bad tea day after day or wearing uncomfortable underwear day after day, I'm saying that I don't matter enough to myself to take care of myself in a way that actually feels good, that I don't love myself enough to make choices that serve the possibility of greater comfort and happiness in my life. And that's a big deal, because when you do it with these minor things like tea and underwear, you're definitely doing it with more important things in your life. And conversely, and beautifully in my experience, is that when you start to notice the little things, when you start to set the timer on your tea, and when you start to throw out the underwear that don't feel good, those choices translate to bigger choices in your life. And suddenly you notice that you're doing things more consciously, you're taking care of yourself in a different way, and you also become aware of the things that you may have just done for years that didn't serve you, and you start to eliminate them. And it's self-care is habit, but it starts with, you know, very little things and very simple choices we can make to change the whole way we approach ourselves and our lives that actually stands to make a big difference.
Well, there's a chapter, and I can't remember which one it was, but you end up dancing in your apartment or whatever, in a completely unselfconscious way, right? And it's a similar idea, isn't it? We have this strict rule around ourselves that we enforce. Nobody else has to do it anymore. We enforce it for ourselves, that we, you know, we don't dance correctly, or we don't do this right, and we know I can't lose face, I can't look like a fool and an idiot. And sometimes it's good to say, who gives a dang? You know, I'm going to do what I want to do regardless. And this is sort of a freedom to that, because we think I don't have to be boxed in by my own habitual patterns, you know, by what I've internalized about what's right and wrong, right? There's a great relief to be able to just not be conditioned by those old patterns, if you like.
Absolutely. It takes constant awareness, though, honestly. It's like, because we're so conditioned to be certain ways, and because my experience of my mind is, it's crazy. It wants to stay in control at all costs. It can be very critical, very self-abusive. So bringing awareness to those moments when we're preventing ourselves from being present in our truth is important. And then following up that awareness with different action, you know, because as you said, it's freedom. It equals freedom. And the beauty of it is that though not everyone's going to cheerlead your freedom, you're going to create a space for others to also exercise their authenticity. That's the beauty of authenticity. And I think when I think about the artists and the singers and the teachers and the writers and the anybody that I respond to the most, it's always people whom I feel are the most real, who are just like being who they are and sharing whatever message it is they feel inclined to share, but from that place of truth and from their personality that just feels so real, you know, and unprocessed and all of that. And that's like, that's when I get most inspired and excited.
Right. Absolutely. There's a sort of vulnerability, isn't there? There's a trust in those folks, you know, that they know they're in a safe universe, that all is well. And so I can be who I am. I don't have to protect myself. I don't have to be defensive. And really only our humanness, our ego, you know, wants to defend. You know, when we are in touch with that core of ourselves, you know, that there's just a natural freedom that comes from that. It's very refreshing. Actually, I don't think there's anything quite like it. You know, that is the taste of freedom, the taste of enlightenment is just being completely naturally ourselves, right? And
yeah.
It's so beautiful to be there. Because I think some people think they have to perfect themselves, have to, you know, do some serious work to become enlightened and all that. I used to think that way, you know, that there was a path to enlightenment, and you admired these so-called realized beings and everything.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's sort of such an illusion because, you know, it's, number one, it's linear, it's time-based, and enlightenment, or, you know, the spirit is beyond time. And so it's just a natural being comfortable in your own skin, really, I think, is that recognition of freedom, of enlightened consciousness.
Absolutely. I'll tell you, when I finally stopped chasing enlightenment, my world relaxed so much. You know,
yes.
like you were suggesting there, enlightenment was all I wanted. I was on the path to enlightenment. It was the most important thing to me. All the choices I was making in my life were because I thought those choices would lead me to enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And it's just silly. And letting go of that mission. And enlightenment also, I just don't even experience it in any way as something somebody achieves. That's not how it works. So putting all your energy into achieving something that doesn't even operate in that realm, it became very silly, but also very freeing to let go of it and to recognize that when I'm choosing love and I'm choosing kindness and compassion and I'm choosing forgiveness, that I don't need to make those choices with enlightenment as a goal. I'll make those choices because it feels good to make those choices, and those choices serve not just me, but the world. Like, these are the choices that are the most powerful and make the most difference. Anything that's rooted in the energy of love will always be, in my opinion, the most powerful choice you can make.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and things show up in strange forms, don't they? You look at the great stories, the mythology, even fairy tales. You know, the person shows up in, an ugly witch form, but they're really here to bless us, or it shows up as a frog and we're supposed to kiss it, you know, it become the prince,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think this is so true in our lives too. It's not just fairy tales, right? And you have that wonderful chapter, The Coffer. So, you know, a wise guide can show up as the coffer, right?
Absolutely.
Everything is grist for the mill, as Ram Dass said way back when. You know, it's all for good. That doesn't mean, oh yeah, Pollyanna is lovely, it's all good, you know, because some things really are awful. But even within that, I think there's something that can help us to open to this love, this big love you're talking about. We've got a couple of minutes before the break. Tell us about The Coffer.
Well, The Coffer is, I cough a lot. I make a lot of noise, like with my nose and throat, and it's something I'm very self-conscious about, and it is exacerbated when I'm nervous. It's like a tic, basically. And
right.
I was at the airport, and I was sitting near a man who was letting out this gargantuan cough. I mean, it was so big. It was truly, truly this explosive cough, and like every minute, and it would just be one booming sound. It wasn't like a, it was just big and booming. And then he was just reading his paper very casually, would let out this enormous cough, and then get back, you know, read his paper. And I looked at him, and I was just amazed by his nonchalance, which I attribute in some part to his age. I think he was probably in his 70s, and I'm 46 now, and I noticed that age, one of the gifts of age is that I've started also to care less about a lot of things I cared more about when I was younger. But he was just very free in the way that he was coughing, and it highlighted for me all of the shame that I've carried around my cough and embarrassment, because I feel like it's coming from an emotional place inside of me. It's a physical manifestation, but really beneath it is something emotional, and feel like I'm out here as this, in the eyes of some sort of spiritual teacher or guide or whatever, and I can't even, you know, keep myself from coughing all the time because of all of my emotional hang-ups. So it's had me feeling a lot of shame throughout the years, and that's ultimately what the chapter is about. It's about looking at our shame and recognizing that Our shame lives in our secrets. Our shame lives in those things that we're too embarrassed to reveal, so we keep them hidden. But once we start announcing those things, you know, to a close friend or to a therapist or a support group or a stranger, we take away the power of shame simply in the verbalization of those things we're ashamed of. And I've seen that time and time again in my life in terms of my sexuality growing up as a gay man and feeling incredibly ashamed of my sexuality in my younger years, and realizing that the more I was open with it and the more I started to come out to this person and to this next person, the freedom that comes from releasing the shame, you know, that keeps us hiding is another indescribable freedom. And so that's the essence of what that chapter is about, looking at shame through a different lens.
Yes, very good. And of course, we're going through that in a sense, aren't we, with all the sexual harassment stories we're hearing about now, and women moving beyond the shame of, you know, staying stuck in hiding the truth and getting it out there. And it's shocking, I think, just because this is so prevalent, that this, you know, abuse of by men of women. But, you know, we celebrate the fact that it is coming out, I guess, in that sense, too. It's no longer hidden, and that can only be a good thing, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is destroying walls. I mean, this is a watershed moment, and that is the power of speaking your truth and the truth of your experience. It's creating an important change right now.
Yes. Folks, I'm with Scott Stabile. We're talking about his book, Big Love, The Power of Living with a Wide Open Heart. Just that title sounds inspiring, doesn't it? We all want to have a wide open heart. We're going to talk some more after the break, but right now, listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be right back.
Wouldn't you like to share the programs that inspire you most with audiences around the world? That's easier than ever with mobile giving. Just text Unity Radio to 72727 and help us continue offering spiritual programs that change lives.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
So welcome back to today's show. Yeah, and if you check out my website, I just did a three-part series called The No Fear Bible, looking at it from a Unity perspective. So you might want to check that out. They are very well received messages on metaphysics and the journey of consciousness. So they're called the No Fear Bible. Should be up on my website. All right, I'm with Scott Stabile. We're talking about his book Big Love, and it's harmlessly authentic, you know, disarmingly, I should say, disarmingly, that's what I'm looking for, disarmingly authentic. It is harmless too. I think it's it didn't hurt. It didn't hurt me. It didn't hurt me to read it. But you know, you talk a lot about failure too, and you know, you excel in that really, because you know the flop of your film is the greatest flop ever, so, supposedly, right? So well done.
Literally, yes. Thank you.
A failure, and you know, I think that's a technique too, isn't it? Is you know, I was taught that by someone years ago, that if you got a problem, then magnify it. You know, make it the biggest problem you could imagine. You know, see it as the size of the universe. Eventually, it'll get so ridiculous that it'll explode. You know, like a big balloon, and you'll realize, man, why was I giving so much power to that? But you know, to see these things as, you know, it's not life threatening here. You know, okay, it flopped, or I'm a failure in that regard. You know, okay, but yeah, look around, I'm still here. So I think if we could see it in that way, you know, we move beyond being so attached to our quote problems or failures or difficulties, and see them as just, you know, passing circumstances, and that we're still the integral person that we always were.
Absolutely. I think that's beautifully put. I like that idea of the letting it expand so large that it becomes ridiculous. And the other night I was kind of, what do you call yourself, Mr. Grumpy? I was a Mr. I call myself moody often, because I am moody often, but I had one of these kind of moody, self-critical days a couple days ago. And in the evening, I sat in meditation and was, you know, had my eyes closed and was just taking deep breaths. And I was imagining myself, you were talking about imagining the situation growing and expanding until it becomes ridiculous and pops. Well, I was imagining myself and my energy field just growing, like with each inhale, that I was just becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and that everything that was frustrating me through the day about the world and about myself, I could hold it all, and I could hold it all comfortably, because my energy and my expansiveness was so big that all of those things just kind of melted within my expansiveness. So it's kind of a reverse of what you're saying, but it had a very similar sort of impact, because I realized that when I open myself up and really, really expand, that I can hold whatever life throws at me, and I can hold whatever my mind throws at me, and I can actually do it in a way that is much more peaceful and much more comfortable than when I'm like clenched and resisting everything that's going on in my life, you know?
Right, and I think it points to the same thing too, because as we let the problem expand, the universe allows it to do so, right? Because the universe is so large and so wondrous and expansive, as you said, that it can allow this to happen, and when it bursts, you realize, oh, there I am in the universe. I'm in the limitless, you know, expansive universe, and so it leads you to the same place, if you like.
Yeah, I like that.
So you talk about happiness, but it's not all about happiness, is it? Because you know, we're told in America, you know, that it's life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, you know, we've got to be happy all the time. But I think there's something deeper than happiness.
Well, I mean, we're also in the, if you're, you know, in the metaphysical world in any way, or a spiritual seeker, or in the self-help movement, you're being inundated with the message that you can choose happiness, and that happiness is a choice. And essentially, a piece of that chapter is about making a very different claim that happiness is not a choice, it's a feeling, and we don't choose our feelings, and that we can absolutely choose the actions we take that stand to lead us toward happiness generally. Like if I use the example of playing tennis, and I love to play tennis, so I know that when I go to play tennis, there's a good chance that I'll create more happiness in my life. But choosing to play tennis and choosing happiness are two very different things. And when we're being told that happiness is a choice all the time, and yet we find ourselves sad or frustrated or moody or grumpy or all these other things that are very real human emotions, we not only feel those emotions, but then we begin to feel like we're failing somehow, because if we should be able to choose happiness, why can't I choose it in this moment? Like, what's wrong with me? And I think it's just a reframing of how we look at it, and then also remembering that life's about much more than happiness, which is what you were saying in the beginning. It's like, my sadness has taught me deep empathy for other people. You know, because of what I've been through in my life, I feel like I can sit with people who are in pain in a completely different way, much more compassionately, much more presently, and that's important. And anger is, for me, an incredibly important emotion as well. Like, anger is the thing that, like, gets me off my butt because I feel like there's some injustice happening in the world and I'm angry about it. And there's use in anger. You know, anger, I don't think on its own is a healer. I think that it's a catalyst, but we're always served by seeing how our love and compassion can use that anger in a more positive way. But, you know, all the emotions exist, and we're humans, and we feel them all. So, you know, we don't have to be happy all the time. And we
can. No. Absolutely. And, you know, the story that you have around the trainer that you
were
working with in Panama. I think that's a lovely story, too, because, you know, he was a very gentle soul, wasn't he? Although he was a strong man, you know, physically and in his mentally as well. But, you know, you tell the story of his experience with a homeless man in McDonald's and nobody wanted him to give this man a meal, and the fact they all had to leave the restaurant, but he did it anyway. I think there's natural grace and love in that person, you know, because he wanted to do the highest and best, even when it didn't feel good, you know, even when it wasn't a happy experience, right? But sometimes we do things that it's not always happy. It's not, but there's a deep sense of doing the right thing, you know, in a very natural and gentle way, and he exhibited that. So it's very inspiring, that story.
Yeah, he's so lovely. I haven't talked to him in a couple of years now, but he's a really beautiful human being. It's interesting because he left the experience feeling really down and really upset because the other patrons in the McDonald's were so dismissive and disdainful, and the manager ended up kicking out this person, and Juan Carlos, you know, bought him a lunch and went and sat outside on the sidewalk with him. Juan Carlos was so upset because of how the others reacted. And I said, yeah, but look at how you reacted. Look at the gift you gave this man in his life. And I assure you that he's probably used to receiving disdainful looks from people, but what you gave him is the thing that he's going to carry with him into that day, you know, because that you were the exception. And kindness is, you know, I talk a lot about the mandates of love and the different mandates, and kindness for me is just the easiest. We all know how to be kind. We all know what it feels like to receive kindness. And, you know, I think that a lot of people will write me and say, I feel very paralyzed, like, the world's too dark, it's too violent, there's nothing I can do that's going to make a difference. And I always respond that kindness, that there's so much power in it. Step outside your door and engage with the people of your community with an open heart, and you'll be making a profound difference. When you wake up and you go into the bathroom and you're looking at yourself in the mirror and you're calling yourself fat and ugly and stupid and whatever else you call yourself, interrupt that train of thought and be kind to yourself and loving to yourself. This is love in action, and this is the power of love in action. Like, we can't necessarily affect whether or not we go to war with Korea, but we can absolutely serve the community that we live in and be of service to our friends and our neighbors and strangers, and that has profound impact.
Absolutely, yeah. We do need to note, though, that both McDonald's and the undergarment industry are now trying to block Scott's book.
I hope they try to block my book.
At all. That was just a joke.
That would give it amazing publicity. I hope that happens.
Yeah, there we go. My first minister told me all publicity is good publicity. So
right.
I'm not sure if that's actually true, but it sounds plausible anyway. So you were involved in what you call a cult for a number of years, right? And I think the leader of that cult said, you know, if we are a cult, then we're a cult of yes, you know, and seeming to be very positive about that. But, you know, and maybe there's the essence of it, because, you know, we all like yes, but I think no is also important, right? Jesus talked about this, you know, when you say something, let your yes be yes and your no be no. He knew that there's a balance there. And there has to be sometimes a no to things, you know. And I think this is important, say, with homeless people or with any other despised minority, you know. Not all the despised minority are perhaps genuine folks. Maybe they're manipulating the system, you know. And sometimes it's okay to say no to them, because otherwise we're enabling. It's a bit like tough love with our teenagers or whatever, you know, that we have to say no, because otherwise we're losing our own integrity there. So just wanted to point that out. It's not like we have to, you know, help the whole world here. Sometimes we help by saying no. Yeah,
look, I think whatever's true for you in the moment is what ultimately is going to serve you. I think that if we're saying yes to things but we're feeling no, that's often not going to be helpful. And if we're saying no to things but we're feeling yes, it's the same thing. Then we're preventing ourselves from doing things. So I think, you know, it's really going back to that idea of authenticity and truth, and really, you know, bringing awareness to what your yes or your no is in the moment, and as often as possible, honor that and trust that by honoring it, you know, you're moving forward exactly how you need to move forward, and you're serving all involved.
Yeah, I love that response, because it really grounds it in that moment, doesn't it? And we know, you know, we have that wisdom mind that knows, and we don't always trust it because we live from conditioned mind or habitual mind or, you know, whatever it is. But if we trust that, I think it was Chogyam Trungpa that said, first thought, best thought. And I've always liked that. In other words, what spirit brings us in that moment is often the highest, you know. And if we start trying to second guess everything after that event, we might get it wrong, right? So we have to trust. Right. I think a big part of this is trusting that heart that is deeply compassionate, deeply wise.
Yeah, it's so, absolutely, and it's so tough. You know, it's so tough because most people are not operating in that way, you know, and we're not growing up in that way. We're not being taught to function in that way. And so, you know, it's tough, but absolutely not impossible to break ourselves free of that conditioning. And every time we do it, you know, every time we're making a choice more aligned with spirit, every single time we're serving ourselves, and we're putting, like, money in the bank, for lack of a better way, to, you know, like, we're growing in our ability to continue to make those choices moving forward.
Right. And it's so hard sometimes to have that big love, you know, because we've all heard about this, I think it's the Stockholm Syndrome or whatever, you know, abused children have it, you know, where they defend their parents, even though their parents are the abusers or whatever. And we begin to identify with, you're saying, a cult leader, for instance. So we want to protect that cult leader, even though we know in our heart that person is not, you know, acting in our best interest. So it's really hard to move beyond that small sense of wanting to serve things that don't serve us, you know, and enter that place of big love. That's a shift, isn't it? Shifting consciousness to allow that to happen. Because I know on a daily basis I go there sometimes. I'll go into my small mind or small love, you know, tribal love, as opposed to this larger, more expansive love.
Absolutely. I'm with you there. Look, I think that it's incredibly hard work. And I think that, you know, love gets a bad rap, because when you talk a lot about love, people can tune out and think it's, you know, ooey-gooey or airy-fairy or, you know, not really grounded. But my experience of love is that love is almost always the harder choice to make. You know, when someone's coming at you with anger or blame, it's incredibly easy to respond in kind with anger. You know, but actually showing up with love in a moment like that, it takes hard work and it takes commitment. And, you know, from my perspective, it's the thing that has served my life more than anything else, is whenever I'm operating from that, you know, high mind, high spirited, loving place, I feel the best, and I know I'm serving myself, and I know I'm serving the world. So it's hard work, but it's completely worth doing. And it's also important to recognize, like, I'm often not loving. You know, I'm often impatient and, you know, blameful and those things as well, and that's part of being a human, and that's okay too. And, you know, I like to ask the question often, you know, what does love invite me to do in this moment? That kind of regrounds me and reconnects me with the big love notion, you know.
Yes.
And we're always served by reconnecting with love, always, always, always.
There's a great chapter on, you know, the opposite of that. You know, you call it meltdown, where you just had enough of living in Panama. We haven't got time to go into the details of that right now, but a wonderful experience for you, right, to learn so much about yourself and your intensity at that time and your lack of empathy for your partner, right? And because you had such a burning desire to shift something that you weren't able to evidence very much love at that point, but on the other hand, it was necessary, right? It was something that you learned a great deal from.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're all works in progress. I mean, that chapter was all about communication, and I used myself as an example of the worst communicator ever in this experience with my partner.
Right.
And you know, relationships, all relationships certainly, but our most intimate relationships, I think, they push all the buttons, and they show us what needs work, I think, more than anything else. You know, they show us those areas where we are not operating in as loving a space as we could. And I love my partner, and I'm very grateful for my relationship, and we're about to celebrate 10 years, and he's the person who drives me the most crazy, and vice versa. And, you know, he's the person who gets the ugliest version of me. And that's tough, but I also, you know, all we can do is keep working, you know, keep owning it when we're the ones showing up, you know, raging and blameful and whatever else we're showing up. If we can own it and take responsibility for how we're showing up, that's the first step to getting back to love, you know, to shifting.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. And that's another thing about the book, folks, is that these stories can be taken at one level. You know, there's somebody telling their life story at certain aspects that have happened. But they're also teaching stories. They're parables of significance for all of us. And so there's a deeper context to them. So when you read the book, you get the fun of the presenting story, but then you get to muse about it, and, you know, what does that show me about myself, and what's really going on here in our interactions and the ways we show up for each other and for this world. So in that sense, it's moving at different levels here, depending on how we want to read the book, so which makes it, you know, doubly interesting to read. You end with a chapter on forgiveness, right? Yeah, so tell us about that.
Well, the chapter's it's on forgiveness, and it talks about the process I went through of forgiving the man who killed my parents. And, you know, I believe in forgiveness. I don't see things as unforgivable. It's not how I view forgiveness, basically, is that if I were to see an action as unforgivable, then the statement I'm making is that action carries more darkness than the light and love that lives in my heart. And I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that's true. So I see the possibility of forgiveness always. And it certainly wasn't the case always with the man who killed my parents, in part because I was 14 and I wasn't even considering forgiveness for many years. But I started, one, to recognize the toll it was taking when I would think about him, and just feeling hateful and vengeful and all of that ugliness, how toxic and disgusting that feels inside. And I knew that I wanted to consider forgiveness, but I didn't really know how I would get there. And then it was all empathy in the end. You know, I started to imagine what his experience might be like, what his struggle might be like. I started to recognize that anyone who's operating from any self-worth and self-love or who feels seen in this world would never murder people. It just is not possible. You know, it's not possible to be operating from a space of love and kill people. And so I couldn't relate to killing anybody, but I could certainly relate to feeling unseen and unworthy and unloved, and I could relate to being so angry at moments that I wished people would just die. Like, I could relate to all those very human things. And so without knowing his precise circumstances of his life, I tried to imagine his struggle and just to really connect to his humanity. And it was when it was like, by doing so, by bringing empathy and compassion to my view of him, forgiveness eventually found me. And I recognized when I would think about him, it wasn't with the rage, it wasn't with the blame, it was with love, it was with forgiveness. And that for me was a life-changing gift, to know that I could face a situation that most people would see as unforgivable and still find my way to forgiveness. You know, that was right. One of those gifts in the darkness.
Absolutely. Beautifully put. And of course, we understand that, you know, forgiveness enables us to be free, because we don't want to be stuck in those. Yeah, we're doing ourselves a huge favor by forgiving. And, you know, justice is not what vengeance is mine, says the Lord, right? The balance is balanced by the universe. We don't have to be the ones being the judge and jury on these things either. Folks, I'm out of time, unfortunately. This has been a fantastic hour. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Scott. Next week, Nikki Scully joins me to talk about her latest book. It's called Sekhmet, Transformation in the Belly of the Goddess. So that should be interesting. But right now, Scott, thank you so much. What a wonderful person you are.
Paul, you too. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for all the love that you're sharing with the world. This is important work.
Yeah, and best wishes to you. And hopefully you'll be on my show again sometime down the line.
Anytime. That'd be great. Yeah, please, anytime.
All right. Okay. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Have a good week. Happy Thanksgiving if you're listening live this week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world, and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Of spiritually conscious living start now. For a time-tested method to live with purpose and release your infinite potential, tune in to the Yoga Hour, Living the Eternal Way, with Yogacharya Ellen Grace O'Brien, every Thursday morning at 10 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Pacific, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Every day we're faced with countless decisions, some seemingly insignificant, others life-changing. In each situation, we want to consider all the options. But in an effort to choose wisely, I may become anxious and confused, thinking that my peace of mind depends upon making the right decision. Perhaps this is backwards thinking. Actually, beginning with peace of mind helps me make good decisions. Peace is not the result of a particular circumstance, but the very cause that keeps me calm no matter what I'm facing. inner peace clears my mind of doubt and allows me to see what would serve me best. When I have to make a choice, I remember, for every question there is an answer, and that answer begins with the peace I already have. Peace can begin with me.
To find a Unity Church near you, please visit our website at www.unity.org.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.